We'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and I apologize, we had some technical difficulty, but they have that all taken care of now, so we're ready to go. Representative Barr, have you had a chance to read the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have, and I move the minutes of February 27th.
All right.
Approved.
Representative Barr moves the minutes dated February 27th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Members, today we have a very special guest. Is Kaylee here? If Kaylee and her family would like to come up front, if that's okay. Kaylee, you want to bring your family? Want to come up front to, you brought your little brother too? Did you? All right, so if you want to, please, you can sit down in that chair right there. Pardon me. Oh, and Rachel says you have great shoes as well. All right. So, members, today we have a very special guest. And just so, if there's anybody new to the committee, what we like to do is we like to recognize someone special as it pertains to agriculture. And this can be anybody as far as we've recognized people who are we've recognized, I think, Tom Peterson, the lobbyist, was one of the first recognitions. We recognize individual farmers, just anybody who has done something special, right, as it pertains to agriculture. And today we have a very special guest. And we have a resolution here for you, right? So what I'd like to do is read the resolution, and then we want to hear from you if you're okay with that. Are you okay with that? All right. So we have a House resolution honoring Kaylee Roth for her contributions to Second Harvest. Whereas those who selflessly volunteer their time and energy to help others in the community who are in need perform a valuable service deserving of special legislative recognition. And whereas at the young age of 7, Kaylee wanted to collect food for Second Harvest, she set paper bags in front of each house on her block, along with a note saying she would come back in a few days if they put food in the bags to give to families who are less fortunate. And whereas, with the help of her parents, she collected and delivered 400 pounds of food to Second Harvest, and whereas the second year she collected 728 pounds of food, and in 2017, 1,066 pounds. The 200 paper bags of food she donated came from homes in about 6 city blocks. And whereas Kaylee and her parents' goal is to do something bigger every year, now therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the Minnesota House of Representatives that it commends Kaylee Roth for collecting and donating thousands of food to Second Harvest Heartland and extends best wishes to her in the future. It's dated February 6th, signed by the Speaker of the House, Kurt Dowd, Joyce Pepin, the Chair of Rules and Legislative Administration, and myself, Chairman of Agriculture. So with that, members, let's recognize Kaylee. Yes, thank you. So that is fantastic. Now, what we ask you to do, all right, speak into the microphone and state your name for the record, okay, so we know who you are, and then tell us a little bit about yourself and what motivated you to do this.
Hello, I'm Kaylee. I'm 11, and I live in Edina, and I go to school. I'm a fifth grader, and I go to Concord Elementary School, and so me and my mom were cleaning out like our closet, like full of like paper bags from when we go to like Jerry's and stuff, and we were like, I was like, we should do something with them to get rid of them because we're so lucky that we like go to the Target 3 times a week, and and so I was like, some people don't get to do that, and so we should like give food to them. And so, and then I wrote a note and take and like stapled it to paper bags, and I had like my friends help me pass them out, and then we always do this around, like, Thanksgiving time and stuff, so, yeah.
Well, that is fantastic. So, who do you have with you today?
This is my mom.
Okay.
That's my dad, and that's my brother.
And your brother. So, does your brother help?
Yeah.
Yeah?
He, like, runs around and picks them up, and he's like, there's a bag over there!
Wonderful. So, do we have any questions or comments from the members? No? Any questions from the members? So, well, we want to thank you so much for coming out today. We do have a resolution for you, okay, that you can take this with you. And we can't thank you enough for what you have done. This is fantastic, and you're an inspiration to so many. So, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So, for the next testifiers, we'll see if you can top that performance, right? So, next on the list, we have presentations from the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. So, let's see, I believe we have Ms. Coles, is that right? That's a tough act to follow. You know that.
But she can do it.
But she can do it, yeah.
It's a tough act to follow, but we do have beef jerky, so.
Oh, that helps, right?
It helps just a little bit.
Gets you a little closer.
Yeah.
So, well, please state. Wait a minute. All right, I'll finish my comment. Please state your name for the record and who you represent and begin.
That's who we're representing.
And ask, you want me to, you can ask that. He wants to know and state who your representative is what he said. So, no, please state your name for the record and begin.
Ashley Coles, Executive Director of the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. With me, I have Peter Bakken, a beef farmer from the Laverne area, and then Karen Schaefer, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Beef Council.
Thank you.
Chairman Hamilton, committee members, thank you for allowing us to join you today. If you take a look around the room, most of them have removed their hats, but there are a lot of cattlemen in the room today. So if you guys want to raise your hands, let your presence be known. Today is our official day on the Hill, but we have like Bruce Clavin here every single day. We like to bring our members in for a special day on the Hill so they can visit with you guys one-on-one in your offices. The state of Minnesota has more than 16,000 cattle producers, and the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association is the policy arm of the beef industry here. We're a membership-based organization, and our mission is to create and maintain an economic and political climate that provides cattlemen the opportunity to grow the beef industry here in the state of Minnesota. In a little bit, you're going to hear from Karen Schaefer. They put together an economic impact a study of what the beef industry contributes to the state of Minnesota. But first, we're going to talk about the guy in the middle here. So Peter Bakken was recognized this past January amongst peers at our National Cattlemen's Association meeting for the good work that they do on their farm when it comes to beef quality assurance. They were nominated for a national award and won that national award, which for me has an elevated level of pride because Minnesota is not necessarily known as a cattle feeding state. And so to have a cattle feeder award come back to the state of Minnesota is something I think we all should be proud of and we are very proud of. So as part of that, the Bakken family got to spend some time with a professional video crew. And so we do have a short video to share with you guys. So hopefully it works. Mark, where's it? Can you hear it?
Anyone? you have a comment?
From my grandpa. My dad did that.
Yeah. Okay. Located
in Rock County on the western edge of Minnesota, Black Lex Farms is a family-owned cattle feeding operation that's now in the hands of brothers Peter and Jay Bakken.
Black Lex Farms, Inc. Black Lex is an acronym, Bakken Land and Cattle. Barlex is a brand. My great-great-grandpa came over on the boat from Norway, and then my grandpa farmed, and my dad took over from my grandpa. My dad and grandpa were milking at the time and raising some pigs. My dad didn't want to do that all of his life, so he decided to move across the road when that place came up for sale and started feeding some cattle. So Jay and I are fourth-generation farmers, but second-generation cattle feeders.
In addition to the feedlot, the Bakken family grows crops and has their own cow-calf herd. Peter and Jay have expanded the cattle feeding facilities to a capacity of nearly 3,000 head. Each day they strive to provide the highest level of animal health and comfort.
You know, the whole beef quality assurance thing to me is not just about us. It's about animal care and taking care of the animal. You know, we've all figured out that the better you take care of the animals, the better they'll perform for you. It seems like there's always something you can make better, and that's what we're working to do.
Because it's the right thing to do. It just is. I mean, if you do them the way you're supposed to do them, you'll be financially rewarded for them, so why not do it?
Whether it's unloading cattle in the middle of the night or making sure the water tanks are clean, on Black Lex Farms, each BQA practice they follow is another step toward building trust with consumers. And it's easy to see that this family is committed to taking every step they can to produce healthy cattle that yield high-quality beef.
You're always looking to improve. I mean, that's the beauty of being your own boss and having your own operation, is there's always something better you can do. And I think that's the reason that you have all the people on your team and you have a beef quality assurance program and you work with associations like the cattlemen and the state cattlemen and the beef council and your local vet. I'm a believer in the beef quality assurance program because the last word, assurance. To me, why are we out here doing this? We're out here doing this to provide a quality beef product to the consumer.
Very nice.
So I guess a little bit more background about beef quality assurance. It's funded through our check-off program here in the state of Minnesota. And I think a common trait amongst everybody who participates in the beef quality assurance program is they are striving for continuous improvement, and not just on farm, but in all practices across the beef industry. There are four potential producer awards, national awards for beef quality assurance, and actually two of them came back to Minnesota this year. Central Livestock Association, who has branches across the state, and Jeff Reed is here with Central Livestock. They also won the Marketer Award, and we'll be highlighting them in the Senate committee this afternoon, but I wanted to recognize him here as well.
Very nice.
So if you guys have any questions for Peter, he is willing to answer any questions you guys may have.
Yeah. Any questions? I do have one, but anyone? Yes, Representative Keel.
I don't. I just want to thank all these beef farmers. I love steak. I really appreciate the hard work you do.
Right. Thank you for those comments. And I'm going to take just a quick break here to recognize somebody, and I'm going to come back with my question for Mr. Bakken. Today we do have Bethel Academy here from Bloomington, right? We'll recognize and just
Bethany.
Isn't that? Oh, it's wrote down Bethel. I'm sorry. Bethany. So you want to wave, right? All right. Thank you for correcting me. Had it down. Welcome. Glad that you're here. All right, Mr. Bakken. So my first question is, did you ever participate in the Young Farmers and Ranchers discussion meeting?
Here we go. I tell him he needs new material every year. So. See, I was prepared for this. Not really. I never have a good comeback. But yes.
That's because you're lost.
Yes, Representative Hamilton, I have participated in various Farm Bureau activities.
Do you remember who won?
Jeez. I do.
That never gets old.
It does, just not to you.
So, well, thank you for being here, and that was a great video. Thank you for telling your story as well, and we'd love to hear from you if you have any other comments.
Well, I guess the first thing I would like to say is, you know, Ashley is pretty much solely responsible, other than some phone conversations of her and I, as far as filling out the application and whatnot. The rest of it, yeah, we can take some credit for. I do feel there's some responsibility to this award. I mean, it is a national award. My dad started back on this thing a long time ago when nobody knew about MPCA. Nobody, you know, we started from the ground up on pollution control. As you saw in the video, the big pond there, we are a CAFO, a confined animal feeding operation. And I guess Minnesota has touted itself, and Rock County, as a livestock-friendly state. Because of people like you doing your job, I would encourage you to continue to use common sense approaches to keeping us in business. When we ventured into this pollution control or environmentally friendly idea, it was pretty scary. You know, the first guy that came down wrote us a letter, told us we had what was compared to nuclear waste running in the creek. Well, that was a little disheartening, being a cattle feeder and being out of college in 1990 and wanting to take over the family farm. So I guess as far as who we have here today, I just want to say thank you for continuing to try and be a livestock-friendly state, because as Karen will show you in a minute here, you know, it's an economic driver. I mean, just personal story, you know, $6 million is the economic impact to Rock County for us. So thank you.
No, thank you. And yes, absolutely. And I, you know, your father, when he said it's the right thing to do, you know, he hits it spot on with that. And now, again, thank you for your story. Also, thank you for the 3 a.m. message saying that my day was going to be very bright this morning. He sent me a message at 3 o'clock this morning.
Probably when you left home.
And do you realize it was beef quality assurance, because we're calving heifers right now? So to make sure that everybody is duly taken care of at home, we check every 2 to 3 hours.
You are calving, not me.
You don't have to look at your Facebook at 3 a.m.
All right, so now we'll have Karen Schaefer present some of the economic stuff that was referenced.
Well, thank you all. I love the discussion about the Young Farmers and Ranchers discussion meet, as I used to coordinate that program.
Right?
After you two both. But. So my name is Karen Schaefer, and I serve as the executive director of the Minnesota Beef Council. We serve as the checkoff arm to the beef industry. And in fact, this organization and state legislature actually put us and organized us back in 1967. So last year we celebrated 50 years under the beef checkoff program. In 1985, Federal Farm Bill actually created a national program. However, we still do function under the state act and statute in regards to how we're governed and how our organization is structured. The Department of Agriculture does still have oversight over the work that we do. We're made up of a 16-member producer board, so they decide how their investments should be spent and prioritized. We focus in the areas of education, research, and promotion. So one of the projects that we did a couple years ago was we started the work on an economic analysis study for the beef industry in Minnesota. A little work had been done in that, and we knew that beef was big in Minnesota. We just didn't know how big. So this summer we came out, the study came out, and we, in fact, the beef industry in Minnesota creates nearly $5 billion of economic impact to the state. So we're really, really proud of that. A significant portion of that is literally the value of the cattle. We also buy a lot of feed. We also buy, you know, work with our local machinery companies and implement dealers to purchase equipment. So there's just a lot of local economic support, as was mentioned, with Rock County. That's on a city level, a county level, and obviously affecting the state of Minnesota. A couple other exciting things, as Ashley had mentioned, we do have over 16,000 beef producers in this state. The beef industry also creates over 47,000 jobs And we're really excited about that. And actually, labor can sometimes be a challenge, just finding people who are able to help in our industry. So we're really, really excited about those results. Minnesota has grown in the beef industry over the last decade, and we raise both cow-calf, and we're strong in our cow-calf sector as well as our feeding sector. We rank 10th overall amongst all the other states, so we're really proud. You don't maybe think of Minnesota. When you think about beef, you think about Texas, Nebraska, Kansas, but Minnesota is a top 10 cattle producer. And in fact, the other thing that we're really excited to talk about is our export market has significantly grown in the last decade, and the demand for U.S. beef is growing because of the high quality of the products that we produce. And about 13% of all beef products that are produced in the United States are exported. So we see that growing, and we're really excited about the opportunities for cattlemen and cattlewomen in this state.
Very nice. We do have a question. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just want to echo the sentiments of expressing appreciation for all the work that you do. In my role as chair of the Nutrition Commission of the House of Representatives, I assure you that many nights of the week we stress the need to consume more beef here in the state of Minnesota.
I appreciate that.
Maybe Nutrition Commission isn't a real commission, but we do gather each night to eat beef.
I think that's fantastic.
I do have a question. 16,000 cattlemen. What is the? Do you have an average number that they would have in their herd?
So that's actually a really good question. The average herd size in Minnesota is probably about 35 cows. So that's kind of an interesting statistic because we have a lot of people that raise cattle as a part-time position. You know, they maybe have a smaller herd of seed stock cows, but we do have quite a few larger feed yards or larger cow-calf operations, but it's definitely a great opportunity for young farmers and ranchers to get into the beef industry because it doesn't have to be so capital intensive with buildings. You know, obviously cattle have an expense to them, but you can obviously look at grazing pasture land and renting pasture land as an opportunity to get in. But it is kind of unique that with all those cattlemen, there's really an average herd size of about 35 cows.
Representative Erdahl, a follow-up?
No, that was good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the Cattlemen's Association for distributing Jack Links. I believe that there's a good chance this would package in my district over in the 3rd Avenue neighborhood of Mankato. And I had the opportunity to attend a career fair the other day, about a month ago, and they were there. And so I asked them, if you've seen Jack Links, I bet you've seen their ads on TV. They have a little fun. And I said, well, do you transfer that fun into the plant? They said, yes, that's an important way that they operate. But our conversation extended beyond that, and I thought it was important what Jack Links is doing. They reach out to the Somali Refugee Committee community in Mankato, and this is likely packaged, but could well be have packaged by a Somali refugee. And they've been able to reach out and attract and employ a lot of Somali refugees. And so Jack Links is an example of a company that is aggressively working to work with the refugee community and involve them in agriculture, in value-added agriculture. So thanks for sharing this. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for coming. A couple of serious questions here. First of all, thank you for the video, and I think a lot of people don't understand that when you are raising animals, beef or even pork, that when they're under stress, you lose money. And so that's it's how important it is to keep a good, clean, and quality organization going, so I appreciate that being brought out. I want to know what your biggest obstacles are, not just to daily operations, but also to growth.
Who would like to take that? Mr. Bakken?
Well, as Karen mentioned, capital is a big thing, especially in the beef industry, considering what things cost. First and foremost, I guess I would say environmental. You know, we have an animal eats corn. Corn goes through the animal. It creates waste. I think the biggest hurdle that we're going to face, especially with the discussion about nitrogen coming up is we talk about sustainability. I believe that we have a sustainable operation. You know, we raise our own crop, we feed our own cattle, everything complements the next thing in our operation. Basically, that animal produces the fertilizer to grow our next crop. So we are perpetually self-sustaining. But if we're regulated to the point where we can't apply what we produce in a timely fashion, that's where I make the mention of common sense. You know, some things might look good on paper, but when it comes down to the practicality of it, that gets thrown out the window. So the regulation that's coming upon, and not just my industry, but everything, I think is something that, you know, say what you want about the current administration and somewhat dismantling the rules and regulations that have been put forth. Some of that needed to happen because we're getting to the point where the box kept getting smaller and smaller for us to function in. And so I guess that's why I thank you guys as far as I see where we came from with pollution control being basically fearful of going and saying, hey, we have a problem, we'd like to do something with it, and being beat over the head about, boy, you're polluters and you're going to jail or you're going to get a fine or whatever. And now, especially locally in Rock County, you know, I believe Rock County has been put on the map as far as pollution control and dealing with our own problems locally. So we've been able to address some of those. Now, as a CAFO, we function under the federal rules, but we still work real closely with our local land management. You know, we're doing some cover crop things, some things like that where we can sequester nitrogen and preserve our organic matter and those types of things. So I guess lengthy answer to a short question is regulation.
Can I add to that? So
yes,
another hurdle for us within the beef industry. So in 2015, a major beef processor, closed in the Corn Arbor state where we have the highest concentration of cattle fed or finished. And so when it comes to finishing cattle in the state of Minnesota, in order to market those animals, they have to leave the state. And, you know, there's different economic reasons why we don't necessarily like that. But I put in a conversation with Representative Hamilton a couple weeks ago, if we would ever have a disease challenge, a significant disease challenge, like foot and mouth disease in the state of Minnesota, and we couldn't ship cattle outside of the state of Minnesota, business continuity for cattle feeders is basically non-existent because we don't have processing capacity in our state. So that is definitely a big hurdle for our industry. And so we talk amongst ourselves about, you know, what we can do to change that, but it's something that you're going to be hearing from our members, what we can do to build some infrastructure for processing capacity or kind of revamp infrastructure that's already here and sitting empty for processing capacity.
Representative Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. If I can help you in any way, let me know. That would be great. You brought up the nitrogen issue, and I'm right now in the process of getting a bill that would require the Department of Ag to do some testing on state lands to see how much nitrogen occurs naturally, because that's something I haven't been able to get an answer for, and I can't hardly believe that, but they don't know that. But can you, for the record, tell the people in this room and whoever's listening, what happens to your crops after they've used up the nitrogen in the soil? What happens if you can't put nitrogen back on?
Smocking.
That's an easy answer. You don't get a crop.
Thank you.
Representative Green? Oh, okay. Any other questions, members? Seeing none. Any other comments?
Just a brief comment concerning the harvesting facility. I think this is probably my own opinion, but as we went to the National Cattlemen's Convention and it was touched on that a lot of these awards spend their time, Nebraska, Texas, those kinds of areas. I think because of ethanol byproducts or co-products, the fact that we raise corn and the feed sources that we use, that whole cattle feeding area is moving up here because we have the feed closer to home. So just something to keep in mind when you're thinking about things and saying, oh, I don't think we have the capacity that we need, or the need for a processing facility up here. I think the cattle feeding belt is moving north.
Thank you. Mr. Bakken, are you planning for the next generation?
Yes.
When the time comes.
I mean, you mentioned my dad. He has done a very good job at navigating the waters of transfer. They've been pretty rough as of, you know, the past few years. And how do we navigate? And why do we navigate? Because of tax rules. As he says, every generation shouldn't have to start over. We're fortunate enough to be able to pick up where he left off and keep the ball rolling, which then in turn for the state of Minnesota is economic development because we didn't have to start over and pay for the same thing that he paid for already. So, yes, and as a family, we've worked really hard on passing that down to the next generation. But it is a difficult task.
Thank you so much. Any other closing comments, Ms. Coles? Or?
No, thank you, I guess, for your time today. And all these folks that are sitting around the room will be in most of your offices at some point today, so with more beef jerky.
Wonderful. And, yeah. No, thank you for all that you do. You know, agriculture, I've said this multiple times, it's an honorable and a noble profession. So we thank you so much for being here and all that you do. And with that, thank you so much for the testimony. And Ms. Bakken, always great to see you.
Enjoy your AARP card.
We'll let him get away with a few things. Okay. I guess we do have another testifier. Mr. Breitkreitz? Over here? Oh, okay. So, all right, next on the agenda, we're going to be talking about the cover crops piece. And, yes, so as we're getting this one keyed up here a little bit. So you're ready to go?
Yeah.
Here to state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Grant Breitkreitz. I am here with the cattlemen, but this presentation is done on my own behalf. I was asked to do this on cover crops and what they do for water quality, the environment we farm in.
Excellent. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. And as soon as you're ready, just go ahead.
So the best way I can show this is with pictures. And this is I'm going to keep this as short as I possibly can because I could speak about this for days because Dawn and I have done this for a long time in our farming operation and has really changed our farming operation. So the way we explain it now is we're kind of to the point of what we call regenerative farming, not even sustainable anymore. We are regenerating soils on our farms, and I hope to show you that with some of these slides. Obviously, this is a concern where we live in western Minnesota. We see this on a pretty regular basis, so We don't see this off of our lands, and this is part of the topic about cover crops is to stop wind erosion and water erosion. These are the principles that we run our farm by and that apply to cover crops is we try to keep the soil covered all the time, minimize the soil disturbance, increase crop diversity, living root in the soil all the time, and as a cattle producer, I get the ability to integrate livestock, which we feel is key. So we've taken it a long ways. When we started on this path, we were told cover crops could be an issue. This picture shows us actually planting corn. It's a great management tool for us, and obviously there is no chance of wind or water erosion planting into this system. This is just to give you an idea what it looks like, you know, a month later or better. We still have no chance for wind or water erosion. The neat part about all this is, it's kind of a neat thing, but for me as a farmer, it's not. We don't have a rain day anymore. We have changed the soil structure in our soils to be able to withstand heavy equipment traffic. We can do things when a lot of our neighbors can't just because of the root mass and the cover crops that allow us to do this. This is a picture of we had 4/10 of an inch of rain late in the evening. This is the next morning. We're applying fertilizer to our corn crop. We don't even have mud on the tires. this is what the cover crops do for us later in the season. This is in September. This is in a cornfield, and you can see how we still have the soil covered with cover crops, preventing water erosion. And obviously, the corn would be tall enough, we wouldn't have much wind erosion. But this is something that we've seen happening more and more in our area of the state. Is when we get rains, they're very, very large. This is a picture of residue after 8.2 inches of rain that came in a consistent heavy rain. City of Redwood Falls actually received 9 inches that night. The thing that the cover crops have helped us do on our farm is to be able to infiltrate that water. Obviously here we had water that moved. But we do a lot of testing on our farm where we do cover crops, and we can show that we can infiltrate 6 to 12 inches of rainfall per hour on our healthy soils that have been cover cropped. Obviously at some point the soil profile will get full, but when we get these 1 to 4 inch rains, we can pretty much take them in without water erosion. This has been one of our big struggles, is how to adapt cover crops into corn soybean production. This is just one of our drills that we switched over to plant in between the rows of the corn, so we have a living cover crop growing all the time. That is one of our 5 goals, is to have something growing all the time. So by using this method, we have a cover crop started that the corn canopy covers and kind of puts it into dormancy, and as soon as the corn starts maturing, sunlight hits this cover crop and it kicks into gear, so we have a healthy cover crop late in the season. This is just kind of what it looks like. You know, we're trying to keep it covered all the time with cover crops. One of the big reasons we do this is soil temperatures. Soils are a lot like us. They function best at 70 degrees. So the closer we can keep them to 70 degrees, the better they function for us, for water infiltration, for transferring our nutrients to our growing crops. This just kind of gives you an idea of what happens at different levels. At 100 degrees, 15% of the moisture used for growth, and 85% of it is lost in evaporation. Just to give you a little idea of what it looks like, Dawn and I personally run a 3-crop rotation. This would be a cover crop we seeded after wheat. Obviously, we've got our ground covered. We take all our straw off for our livestock operation, but we're doing this to harvest nutrients. We are a livestock operation. We have to spread manure. This is the way we harvest those nutrients to hold them for the next year's cash grain crop, which is usually corn following this. This is what it looks like 6 weeks later. So after a small grain crop, we are actually producing more tonnage per acre than we did with the cash grain crop in cover crops. And as a livestock operation, we harvest 50 to 70% of this with our cattle and leave the rest to cover and for nutrients for the next year's crop. This is just an example of what that interseeding looks like as we take corn silage off. We're taking the entire corn stalk off here, making it into cattle feed, and yet we've got cover immediately on the soil. So, like I said, Dawn and I have done this for a long time, and we understand what the cover crops do for our soil health. The upper left picture is a picture of our soil. The lower right is a picture of our neighbor's soil that doesn't use cover crops. You can see we've got aggregation in our soil. The other stuff is what it is. It doesn't have the aggregation. This aggregation allows us to do what I said before. We don't have rain days. So this was a silage harvest this year. Not much fun, but we could go when our neighbors couldn't because we were running on these cover crops. So there are multiple benefits to the cover crops, I guess, is the point I'm trying to get across. This, on our operation, is our fall tillage pass. We are planting more cover crops after soybeans. It's our goal to keep a living root all the time in our soil. This is a project that we did specifically for our cattle operation. This picture is of our farm. This is what you would call a multi-species mix. There's actually 15 different species of product seeds that we plant at one time to create this picture. This is what it looks like. For those of you that farm, this is very difficult to get in the ground at the right rate with all those different seed sizes, but it can be done. And this is just a mix of what it is. And the point of this is, as cover crops are used, every one of these things we put in this mix, we use for a different function, whether it's to break compaction, water infiltration, cattle feed, pollinators. All of these serve a purpose in the mix. This is what it looks like late in the season. We've dealt with this as a state pheasant habitat. This is how you grow pheasants. I currently, when I feed cattle right now, this time of winter, I currently see 50 pheasant roosters every day. It's more than I saw when I was a kid. This is kind of how we use it. It is a balanced ration for our cattle, and it's doing all the things I previously said about improving soil health for water infiltration and erosion. This is just another glimpse of it. Because I am a cattleman, I'm pretty proud of this, that we graze it year-round. So when I was asked to present about cover crops in our operation, and there's lots of other operations around here, if you have too much water, you need more cover crops, and if you don't have enough water, you need cover crops, because we can get the soil to take the water in to hold it for later production. Just to give you a little idea of what cover crops do, this is a soil pit we dug on our farm in November. We have live living roots 30 inches deep in the soil. That's how we're getting the water infiltration, the porosity in the soil. That's how we change it. This is just another picture of different species side by side. You can see one species has only got root mass down 10 inches, but that's doing a different purpose than the one on the right that's down 17 inches. And this is the way we look at cover crops. This is what it's about. It's growing fertility, roots, and especially earthworms. These are just some extreme examples we've seen. That radish on the right, that's doing some tillage. And this is the other part that we feel so important about on our farm is, in this picture, you can't tell where my pasture land stops and where I'm going to produce my next corn crop. That's the way we like to see it. And this, obviously, is the reward of it, is the clean water. And Dawn and I took the steps, and thanks to the Minnesota Department of Ag for this program, we are a water quality certified farm. As I was told, if you build it, they will come, and the wildlife has come back. That's one of the big benefits. We actually now charge for hunting again on our farm, because we feel we have enough wildlife to facilitate that process.
Right.
So I guess that's my presentation. God has blessed us with this life, and we must leave the land in better condition for the generations to come. So thank you.
Thank you. Very nice. So do you have neighbors stopping by and saying, what are you doing? Individuals swinging by and
yes, it's gotten to the point where we've had to just stop them, and we actually host field days on our farm.
Yeah.
Because of the, I mean, it's in every ag literature piece of paper that gets sent to us about cover crops and what they can do and can't do. And I guess we've shown what they can do and will do to our farm. So, yeah, it's busy on Sundays by our place.
Very nice. So we do have a question. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Beckreitz. It's been it's great information, and I love to see farmers out there doing something different. I just had a few questions. How many acres do you have that are in this no-till cover crop?
We farm about 380 acres of tillable land.
Okay. And then do you have issues with disease overwintering in the crops because of the no-tillage?
No, we don't. The cover crops are the key, we feel, are the key to preventing the diseases in our future crops, because we do it with multi-species. And as producers learn about this, they need to find a reputable seed company that can explain that to them, how the different species work and can affect their operations.
Okay. Representative Munson.
And a couple of follow-up questions. Do you have issues with the soil temp in the spring being low so that you have slow germination?
Mr. Breitkreitz.
We have had this issue brought to us many, many times, so Dawn took it upon herself last year to prove that wrong. We did massive amounts of soil temperature testing, and actually when we have a live, living, green species growing early in the spring, our soil temperatures are actually warmer than the tilled soils. And when I say that, that's warmer 24-hour temperature. Obviously, when the sun's out, black dirt's going to be warmer than our green cover, but a 24-hour soil temperature profile shows that our ground is actually warmer.
Okay. Representative Munson.
And just the last question is, just concerns around the extra nitrogen that would be needed since you're having competition out there in the field from the cover crop. Do you find that the nitrogen that's provided from the cover crop over time is offset by the nitrogen that it uses, or do you actually put more nitrogen out there in the field, and do you use like 28% are using manure from your cattle?
We use livestock manure. We use the specific cover crop species to harvest the nutrients out of that manure as it degrades and is digested by the soil microbes to hold it for the cover crop. It is one problem that we've struggled with in our farming operation is current soil testing methods can't keep up with what we're doing in the soil, so we don't know how far we can possibly reduce our nitrogen. But on our operation, we are down to less than a third of a pound of purchased nitrogen per bushel of corn produced. And we feel we can go farther because the cover crops are harvesting and holding those nutrients in a readily available form for that crop that's growing.
Okay. Representative Munson.
And I just want to ask you one more question. The length of time that you've been doing this, I'm trying to remember if we've had significant period of drought that where you've had competition for water and maybe seen some pressure from the drought on your corn. Is that the case? Or
In 2012, we were quite dry in our area, and we had actually done four rows with, four rows without, and we actually saw a yield increase where we had cover crops compared to where we didn't. The biggest thing that we've seen in our operation is as we've changed our water infiltration ability, we're holding more water all the time and then keeping the soil covered so it can't evaporate.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments for the testifiers? Representative Miller.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I asked your capable CA if I could ask a question, and he just dismissed me. So that sounded really sad, didn't it? So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Somehow, I was going to say.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and Mr. and Mrs. Breitkreutz, thank you very much for not only this presentation but what you do, because I think in agriculture that's the heart and soul. Innovation is the heart and soul of what everyone does. They look for better ways. As you say, you own it, and therefore you're constantly trying to find ways to improve it. Or I guess the gentleman earlier said that, and that's a wonderful thing. I also want to make one comment, then I do have a question. I think one of the things that you're doing is showing the importance of the integration of livestock into agriculture for a healthy ecosystem. I think that's something very important, and we're starting to see more of that. We're starting to see more livestock and crops and all these different things from the same operation, so I encourage more of that. As far as the cost of production, so you're doing cover crops, so the natural assumption is you're doing more work, putting more seeds in, therefore it costs more. But what have you found has been sort of the cost or even the savings that you've seen as you've started doing this?
Mr. Breitkreutz.
The reduction in input costs for us is a long term because we are changing the soil profile. When you're changing Mother Nature, it takes time to change it. But the benefits and the dividends that we're seeing right now is our way reduced input cost as far as seed and fertilizers off the farm. Even herbicide is being reduced due to the cover crops and improved soil health.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. One more question. Have you seen ways in which this can be scalable to larger operations?
Yes, I have neighbors right around me that farm substantially more land than we do that are doing this in a very, very similar way to the way we are. And it has to be done through farmer innovation to do the interseeding part of it is the most difficult part. But there are manufacturers in the state and nationwide that are starting to provide products for us as producers to do this.
Okay. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do apologize to the staff for any way that I may have injured there.
A little late.
Right? Well, the apology's not late. You also have to apologize afterwards. You can't apologize before.
I think I'm losing control here.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Knisley, if you want to see me after committee, I'll wipe the bus tracks off your back for you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Breitkreutz, I have quite a few questions here. Are you close to any water, rivers, things like that where you'd be reacted with the buffer zone stuff? And could you kind of address the nitrogen runoff, phosphate runoff, all those things that we're currently having a big to-do about?
Mr. Breitkreutz.
Yes, Don and I farm along the Minnesota River, on the bluffs and in the valley of the Minnesota River. And obviously, being along the river, we have all the tributary streams flowing through our property and properties that we rent and farm heading for the river. So erosion is key for us. And we learned how we could hold water on our pasture lands first, and then we decided to implement this into our tillable lands. That's why we did it and how we did it.
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Breckert, so you find that you need this buffer zone, or the way you're integrating all the crop rotation and everything else, the buffer zone part is not necessary because you're not having a phosphate runoff, or have you done any testing with that?
Mr. Breckert.
When the buffer law came into place, that's when we stepped up to the plate and got Minnesota Water Ag Quality certified. The way our farm lays out and the way we've done this with the no-till and with cover crops, the continuous cover crops, and the livestock management on our pastures, our whole interview process for the last part of the water quality certification was 45 minutes because we have taken care of the issues that are of concern, and I feel that that certification process looks at all those concerns at every level possible, and that's all it took us to get through there. Was that short amount of time. So,
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Breitkreutz, let's see here. I was going to ask seeds. There's a herbicide treatment on seeds. I know that adds a cost to a 50-pound bag of seeds or cost per acre. Are you using this, or have been able to dial back because of the way some of the different styles you're farming here?
Mr. Breitkreutz.
Dawn and I have been doing this for quite some time, and it, like I've said before, it took a while to change the soil and the biology in the soil. And at a point in our farming history here, we got to a point where we started to see that we did not need traded seeds or insecticides for problems because we had changed the environment, we had changed our cropping rotation. So it's a side effect of the cover crops that we've done. We don't spray for soybean aphids anymore because we have host population of insects that are taking care of them for us. As far as the traded seeds, we don't do that. Cyst nematodes have disappeared because of the after effects of cover crops for soybean production. So it's just the choice we made that we don't have to pay for those traits. It's a profitability thing on our end of it.
Representative Bach?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Breitkreutz, so by changing, with having the cover crops and the rotation you're using, it's freeing up all the extra capital or extra capital you'd need for treated seeds and extra fertilizer and sprays and all the aphid sprays, everything like that. And that's just money you can put back in your pocket then. It's increasing your profitability per acre by not having to spend the extra money.
Right?
It is, and we are investing that money into more seed, for cover crop seed, and building equipment or buying equipment so we can do more cover crop seeding.
Representative Barr?
All right. Mr. Chair, Mr. Breitkreutz, so you've been on the farm here for quite a while, before you started this and then when you converted, so a couple of questions on that. How is your yield per acre? Has that gone up, down? And then the other one, you raise cattle. I was just curious, the cattle you raise, are they leaner, heavier weight when they go to market? How's that affected?
Mr. Breitkreutz.
I guess through the cover crops, we change the health of the soil, which has directly changed the relationship of everything we produce on our farm. to the extent that the crops that we produce to feed our livestock, which most of the stuff we produce on our farm goes to our livestock, is showing up directly in our reduced veterinary bills, our animal health, our production as far as cattle production is, we've figured out how we can maintain the same gains we would in the feedlot on cover crops out in the field. So we're spreading our manure, our nutrients, everything at the same time. As far as our crop production, we're maintaining county average yields or above, depending on the crop. And the farther and farther we get down this, the easier and easier it is to maintain the yields with absolutely no financial loss, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Representative Barr, is that all right?
That's going to be good. Thank you.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to thank you for including this presentation. It's very informative and very positive. I want to thank you for the work you're doing. It's wonderful to hear this story and the impact that you can have on the soil and then in turn the impact that has on both your cropping and your livestock. I think part of this is because this is land that you own and you know that the long-term view of it is important, and I compliment you for that. And I guess I'm wondering, there's a lot of land, ag land in rental arrangements, and not all farmers have the same kind of long-term commitment or long-term view that you might have. Is there a way that we can educate other farmers who might be in a different position but might realize that the long-term effects on soil and farming in general can really be improved by the practices that you put into place, let alone the impacts on water and other things? But if you could just make some comments about that. Thank you.
Mr. Breitkreitz.
That's something that a lot of producers struggle with, is if we're on rented land and it's a year-to-year contract, it's a concern. But as a producer, we can see short-term net profit gains from it. So my perspective on it is we should all dabble in it no matter what our contracts read. But yes, it is a legitimate concern, and we do this on land that we know we're going to have long term, but we're not afraid to do it on short term property either.
Representative Black?
Well, just thank you very much for what you're doing. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Breitkreitz, we really enjoy hearing from producers, and as you can see, we had a number of questions. The presentation was fantastic, and I thank you for that. We do have other testifiers we want to get to as well. If you have any closing remarks at this time.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for what you do here, and thanks for the opportunity to present.
Thank you as well. Very well. Next up to testify would be Mr. Rivers. Are you here?
Yes.
Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Pat Rivers, the Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife with the Department of Natural Resources. Today I'm going to talk briefly about the benefits of grazing on our wildlife management areas, as well as give you a few details of how we're working with farmers to make that happen. Grazing and haying can be an effective management tool to meet very specific habitat management objectives. When I think about, in summary really quickly, it's providing that disturbance that grassland needs, and that disturbance creates diversity. By reducing those taller grasses, just like the last presenter talked about how that corn shaded out his cover crop until fall senescence, by reducing that taller grass, there are benefits to wildflower species and pollinators. It increases plant diversity and also reduces that competition. Having that diverse landscape is better for game and non-game species, including birds, who require a rich diet in insects, which improves with that diverse plant habitat. When we look at a prairie and you see a big blue stem, we forget underneath is a forb layer that's maybe 1 or 2 inches tall. We need to get that forb layer diverse and well-established to get the maximum benefit out of that wildlife habitat. By shortening grass in some areas, we can provide a mix of habitats. We've got tall grasses in one area and shorter grasses, which can be really beneficial for young birds as they need to warm up in the morning and get out of that dew, and then getting back into that taller cover later in the day. Grazing can also open wetlands especially wetlands that are affected by cattails. One of the challenges we have with managing grasslands with spring burning is that season can be very short and be affected by a rain at the wrong day. So we can graze through from mid-May through September and have a much longer habitat management session season. So I'll talk briefly about some of our details of our how we're working with farmers. Currently, we're working with what we call cooperative farming agreements with producers on about 10,000 acres. The average CFA is about 200 acres, although our largest is about 1,500 in the Lacaparral WMA. Work areas in Kitson County, Crookston, Glenwood, and Fergus Falls have all been very active in getting grazing CFAs with producers. So to do that, area wildlife managers will develop a detailed conservation grazing plan and then to work with a producer to come up with a cooperative farming agreement contract that works to that end. This is a relatively new management regime for us. We've been doing it for a number of years, but we're working with producers to make changes that make it better for everybody. For example, we used to require a four-strand fence around all of our grazing units, and we've learned that we can do it much easier for us and the producer by using two-strand hot wire instead of that four-strand. So we're working with producers to get efficiencies in the program. And I will say that it's a lot of work, both for the producer and our wildlife managers up front. It requires relationship building and trust. And then once that's developed, getting that initial contract or CFA developed is important. And then comes fencing, water, and electricity. But the point is, once we have that kind of established for a WMA or in a given work area, we've got the foundation laid for that relationship to have what I think a commissioner would call a working lands approach, where we've got wildlife habitat that's being created and maintained, as well as providing a place for producers to have an economical place to provide for their cattle. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions, and we look forward to continuing to work with producers and hopefully increasing that acreage from 10,000 acres to whatever number we feel we can reach. And thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for the testifier members? Any questions? Seeing none. Well, thank you, and I like the fact that you recognize a need to increase the acreage as well. I was talking to some cattle producers the other day, and they said the same thing. And they look forward to working with you, the DNR, as far as being able to have access to additional land. So thank you for that approach as well.
Thank you very much.
All right. Next on the agenda, we have Dr. You're both coming up, right? Dr. Frels, be first. Yeah. Are you going to come together? That's what I was trying to look up here. All right. Yeah. Very well. And Jungers. All right. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
I'm Dr. Jacob Jungers from the University of Minnesota.
I'm Dr. Catherine Frels, also from the University of Minnesota and part of the Forever Green Initiative.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, committee. And I also really want to thank the previous testifiers, the Cattlemen's Association, Dr. Bakken, Mr. Bakken, and Mr. Breichertz. Us at the Forever Green Initiative, we're working to develop a new generation of crops specifically to help you guys and women. Really what we're trying to do is make sure that we have economically viable, profitable crops, cover crops, perennial crops, to help you comply with those environmental regulations that are obstacles that you might be facing. So that's what you're going to hear about today, the research and development that's going on for these new crops.
Yeah, so thank you, Chairman and committee, for inviting us here today. We are representing the Forever Green Initiative, and like Dr. Youngers just said, we're working to develop new crops and systems that are going to drive new economic opportunities for rural Minnesota, and at the same time those crops and systems are going to protect and improve our environment by reducing erosion and nutrient losses that are contributing to water pollution. And so in addition to those traditional cover crops that some farmers have been making work very well on their farms, we're trying to develop new crops and perennials and cover crops that are going to work for producers that maybe don't have cattle and so can't integrate some of these methods into their system. So thanks. We really want to say thanks to this committee and the representatives who have really championed the Forever Green Initiative, because thanks to the funding from the state of Minnesota, the Forever Green Initiative has become the most comprehensive crop domestication program in the United States. We currently have over 70 faculty, students, postdocs, and research staff working with the Forever Green Initiative, and that's not just the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, that's also economics, food science, plant pathology. It's a very interdisciplinary team working with us. And really, with funding from the state of Minnesota, we have been able to leverage and create a foundation of research that's allowed us to double your investment. So we now have funding sources coming from NSF, USDA, the University of Minnesota has contributed more. We also now have the research that has allowed us to reach out to private donors. We have funding from the Walton Family Foundation, General Mills, and PepsiCo. And that's all made possible by the basic research we were able to do with state dollars. So today, the Forever Green Initiative is covering 14 different crops and systems, and those are all highlighted in the book here. We don't have time to talk about all 14, obviously, so we are just going to give you an update on some of the most promising crops, the ones that are most advanced. So I'll be talking a little bit about the winter annual cash cover crops, and Dr. Youngers will be following up with one of the perennial crops, Kernza. So we also have some additional handouts, and what we'll be covering today is highlighted on these. And so I'll start with Pennycress and Camelina, which are some new alternative cover crops, and they're cash cover crops because they're going to produce a harvestable product early in the spring. They're both winter annuals. We plant them in the fall. Over the winter, they're forming a rosette that's protecting the soil from heavy rainfall, from wind erosion, and also taking up nutrients such as nitrates and preventing those from leaching into our water sources. And then in the early spring, they're flowering. By June, we're producing a harvestable oil seed that can be marketed. It makes a great biofuel feedstock or bioplastic feedstock. And so in just 5 years, we've gone from pennycress being a wild, weedy species to something that is almost domesticated. I work with the breeding team, and we now have pennycress lines that are reduced seed shatter, more uniform germination, and early flowering, which is going to help them better fit into our crop production systems. Another really exciting news, just in the last year, we've developed pennycress lines that have a higher oil content and a better oil profile. They're much more like canola oil, which is going to allow those to be marketed in a higher value market rather than just as a biofuel feedstock. We could approach some of the food markets. So while we've been doing all this breeding and domestication, our agronomy team has really been optimizing the planting, harvesting, and management of these new cash cover crop systems. As you can imagine, it's complicated to take a new species and figure out how to integrate it into our existing cropping systems. And that's truly the goal of these new cash cover crops, is to make them work with our cropping systems that already exist in Minnesota. On the back of the sheet, you can see some of our data showing that pennycress and camelina are taking up excess soil nitrates at the same rate as winter rye, which is really the gold standard of the cover crops. But if you don't have cattle or some other market for that forage, it doesn't have additional economic value. Pennycress and camelina do. That ability to take up nitrates has brought interest in integrating it into other cropping systems beyond corn, soybean, or the spring wheat. We're also, Dr. Scotty Wells is working with the sugar beet growers to follow the early lift sugar beets. In addition to those nutrients uptake, we also have beneficial impacts on pollinators because we're that early season food source. So we're really looking at these two new crops as easy integrations into Minnesota cropping systems.
And Kearns is probably a crop that you may have heard of. It's probably the furthest along in terms of the Forever Green portfolio for commercialization. And that's because we've been spending about two decades to breed this new crop and another 8 years or so here at the University of Minnesota to optimize the agronomics and supply chain research that's been needed to move this crop into a real new enterprise. And state funding has been critical for that so far. And as Catherine mentioned, for every dollar that the state has invested into this Forever Green program, we've been able to come back and get $2.50 per dollar from state funding. And that has positioned Minnesota to be the leader in this growing enterprise. The Forever Green Initiative is a really diverse team. We're working on all aspects of the enterprise, and that's how we're viewing this. We're looking at breeding and genetics, the agronomics, measuring environmental impacts, commercialization, and even food science. What's the best way to use this new crop as a food product? And this is all in an effort to deliver a new profitable crop that simultaneously provides environmental benefits like water quality, which I'll talk about in just a minute. One side, page one of my handout, shows some of the businesses, local businesses here in the Twin Cities and Minnesota beyond, that are using Kearns and Now as an ingredient in food crops or in food products or in beverage products. But it's not just locally and regionally. There's national attention towards Kearns and Now. Cascadian Farms is a subsidiary company of General Mills, and they have committed to using Kearns in a product that will be available nationally within the next couple of years. General Mills has been a supporter of the Forever Green Initiative. They've funded, invested about $1 million so far into research, R&D, on Kearns specifically. And this has been essential to make sure that Minnesota stays the leader in this new growing enterprise that's growing nationally. But I think one of the most exciting aspects of this new crop is its potential to reduce nitrate leaching to groundwater, which is a major problem across most of Minnesota. So if you flip this handout over, you'll see a couple of images. The first is an image of Kearns' deep, dense root system. And this root system can access nitrogen deep in the soil where annual crops typically cannot access nutrients. It also allows the crop to very efficiently take up any nitrogen fertilizer that's applied to it. So that means, first of all, that we don't have to apply as much nitrogen fertilizer to this crop compared to annuals. But second, a lot less of that nitrogen is going to leach to the groundwater when applied to Kearns compared to an annual. And we have some preliminary data from plot-scale studies that were conducted across the state of Minnesota, and that's the figure on the bottom of page 2. What we see here is that nitrogen in the soil water beneath Kearns is 10 times less than it is in some of our annual systems. In this case, the example is a corn and soybean system. But the next step is to scale up this plot-scale research. We need to start implementing and putting this new crop solution on the landscape. And we'd like to start doing that in these highly vulnerable areas of the state where nitrate leaching is a real problem for rural communities. So the map, all the red dots in the map show where wells had nitrate levels that exceeded the safe drinking level limit. And the black stars are where we want to start planting Kearns in these wellhead protection areas, or duismas as well. So we're looking at targeting the sandy soils in central Minnesota, the shallow aquifers in southwestern Minnesota, and the karst geology at the southeast, all of which are really vulnerable to nitrate leaching. So instead of burdening our rural communities to fund multi-million dollar treatment plants to clean out the nitrogen from their drinking water, here we have an opportunity to do it by adding a new profitable crop to the landscape, one that offers novel economic opportunities, as well as providing those environmental benefits like clean water.
And I want to mention that Kernza is just one of more than 15 different crops in the Forever Green profile. And each one is being developed to do just that, provide economic benefits and environmental benefits. So that we don't just have a silver bullet to solve these problems, but we have a suite of solutions that are targeted for very different scenarios. So with that, I'd like to thank you all, and we look forward to the opportunity to continue this important research to improve Minnesota's agricultural economy and the environment.
Thank you. We do have a question. Pardon me. We have Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is very exciting, what you're doing. And I'm just thinking, Mr. Chairman, you know, some of us also sit on the Environment Committee where we're talking about some of these issues. And I'm just thinking maybe we need to invite you to come to that committee and talk. This comment you just made about alternatives to some of the cleanup of the nitrates in the soil. My main question is, how would you, or could you work with us to talk about some urban applications for these perennial crops? They're not all perennial, but we are, I know in my own neighborhood there's a research project going on to look at planting a perennial, small perennial forest. And I think the food value part of what you're talking about is really important to urban farmers. So I don't know if you've been doing anything in that arena, and if you haven't, or you're interested, would you just indicate to me if that's something that you would be interested in? One of the applications, certainly for, look, I'm not sure about Kernza, but looking at pennycress, would be with some of the urban aquaponics that are using that particular plant. But anyway, could you just tell me if you've looked at that issue at all, or anybody else has invited you to consider it?
Who would like to take that? Dr. Ross?
Well, as far as I know, I don't believe anyone is working with any of these crops in the urban system right now. Jake, maybe you have heard it.
Most of our research is focused on like field crop applications, but it's definitely something worth considering. How can we integrate some of these 15 different cropping systems or species into urban environment?
There are definitely species here, especially some of the perennial woody crops or the berry crops, the native products, native species that could definitely be done on a smaller scale than some of our field crops.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I'd be very interested in whatever kind of research we might support for that. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to the fact that the urban community contributes to the problem with what's in our waters and our drinking waters. And this might be a way. We have boulevards that are planted with lawn grass, to which sometimes various fertilizers or pesticides or herbicides are applied. I mean, it just seems like there might be this drawing or this illustration of the Kernza plant is very impressive, how deep it goes and how what a cleaner it is of the nitrate. So I guess maybe if I could just ask you later, if we could just maybe meet and talk, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to work with you on that too. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you also for including this presentation in your agenda. I remember having my first conversation with Dr. Don Wise about his plans for this, and it was very impressive, and I'm really glad that you have made the progress that you've made. And one of the things that impressed me the most about what Dr. Wise talked about was the importance of looking at marketing as well as developing these crops, that it doesn't really help farmers if they hear about a new crop, but there's no market out there for the crops that they're going to sell. So, you know, compliments to the work you're doing in that area as well. Sometimes it's overlooked. And you know, I'm really glad that we're hearing this presentation, and I hope that more producers will hear about the work that you're doing and can expand the crops that you're developing. And just the overall improvements to the soil and to our water quality is really important to pay attention to. So thank you again for your presentation and for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Representative Lean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here. I think personally, I'd much rather see incentives or encouragement for alternative practices, best practices, more than mandates. I mean, it just seems to be more logical, more rational way to go. Just a quick question. How much of your funding comes from the state? Is a dollar a month and then as a percentage?
Doctor, if
you have that information.
Yeah. Dr. Youngers, would you like to take that or Dr.?
I don't have those specific numbers on me. I can get those to you for sure, though.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. One of the things that I've learned in my conversation with Dr. Wise is that the initial investment that the state has made invites other investments, as you mentioned, from General Mills and others who see the progress that you're making and the potential for those companies to make use of this. I did read the other day that General Mills just joined some others to promote organic farming in South Dakota. In fact, they're purchasing 34,000 acres or something like that. And I guess, you know, I've been trying to promote an investment in helping farmers convert to organics and make sure that we're providing the necessary produce that's out there. And I'm wondering if you think that some of the crops that you're developing might help farmers look at other ways of really helping our companies find that kind of produce right here in Minnesota.
I'd like to take that.
I could take that.
Yeah. Dr. Youngers.
Yeah, some of these crops are really well suited to be produced organically. Some are more suited to be produced in conventional systems. And in terms of Kernza, it's actually an excellent crop for farmers to transition to organic. It can use up those 3 years of the transition period, very low inputs, build soil health, and it can provide a economically viable yield without even necessarily the organic certification, just because there is a premium to it for being sustainable. So buyers are willing to pay a little bit extra more for it right now. So we have this portfolio spans the range of conventional to organics, which I think is really important to make sure that we have options suitable for many different types of growers in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Black? Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but just a comment. This has been a very educational and informational meeting today, so I appreciate that. I think we've all been able to learn a little bit more about how we're evolving as a state. I really liked Mr. Breitfreit's comment about being regenerative, more than sustainable even, because I think that's what we're all striving to be able to do is to continue to, for generations to come, to be able to save our soil and have healthy land and water, air, making sure that for the next generations to come that we're all healthy and happy and that we appreciate the earth. And I think, especially in the Forever Green, you know, last week I think it was when Representative Clark had brought forward a bill, I think one of the things that we hopefully strive for as state representatives is maybe to do our best while we're here, but to maybe leave a legacy of in some aspect. And I think Forever Green, when I think of that, I think of Representative Bly, because I know that he was very instrumental in helping us all be educated about it and really to promote it. And so I appreciate, he's another one of our members who will be retiring this year. And so we won't be seeing him around the Capitol maybe next year, unless he comes back as a lobbyist, because some people do that. But I think that it's important to just recognize that we have learned a lot over the last number of years, and Forever Green is one of those solutions, and I appreciate that Representative Bly was instrumental in helping educate us about that, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poppy, and I would echo that. Representative Bly has been a champion on this issue, there's no question about it, and so thank you for those words, those comments. Any other questions or comments, members? No? Any closing comments from either of you?
We appreciate the opportunity. It's great to be out here and sharing our updates with you.
All right, thank you. All right, thank you so much. And I guess we do have 15 minutes. We don't have to use it up. But is there anybody else? I don't have anybody else testifying on the list, so no other testifiers. I just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we should have a runoff on this this battle that has been long going between you and Mr. Bakken, because you know maybe at some point we really have to maybe you know additional judges might have a different outcome.
Hey,
just saying.
You know, I embarrassed him once. I don't know if it's fair to do it again.
Always with the chair. Yeah. You want to restate that, Representative Mahoney?
I don't care. I'm always with the chair.
Yeah. You hear that?
There you go.
Yeah.
What
do you mean? Until it doesn't work for me.
Anytime, Mr. Bakken. Anytime, buddy. With that, we are adjourned.